A homeless man was sitting on a sidewalk with a plastic cup, and as people passed by, he was asking, "Can you spare a dollar?" About then, along came a man who was dressed to the hilt, wearing a Rolex watch, gold jewelry, obviously someone who was very prosperous. The rich man walked past the homeless man with complete indifference, without acknowledging his presence, prompting the homeless man to call out after him and say, "How many more dollars will it take before you finally have enough?" The rich man stopped in his tracks, turned, walked back to the homeless man. "What did you say to me?" he asked. "I said, how many more dollars will it take before you finally have enough?" With that, the rich man reached into the homeless man's plastic cup, pulled a dollar bill out, grinned and said, "Just one more," and turned and walked off with the dollar bill. I'm drawn to that story because it raises for us one of life's most important questions. How much is enough? And that's the question that we're going to grapple with today as we come to the seventh installment in our sermon series, By Their Fruits You Will Know Them, 8 Core Characteristics of Authentic Followers of Jesus. Today we're looking at the seventh core characteristic, which goes to the questions, how much is enough? How should we as followers of Jesus relate to our money and material possessions? Let's start with a prayer. Jesus, money and material possessions are woven into the very fabric of our lives. Every day, we have to make decisions about how to use our financial resources. And we realize that something that's that central to life has to inform our discipleship walk with you. So please, today, give us greater clarity. We ask in your wonderful name, the name of Jesus. Amen. As some of you know, about a month ago, my husband David and I adopted a new doggy. Back in December, our beloved black lab, Lucy, passed away. And since then, I felt led to pray, "God, lead us for our next dog, lead us to an extra needs dog, a special needs dog." You know, the kind of dog that might never be adopted but for us. As I prayed and as we searched the websites of various shelters around Indiana, I came across a dog that seemed to fit that description. She was a golden retriever, labradoodle mix, and from her online description, not only was she getting a little up there in years, but she seemed to have some special behavioral needs. And so we made our way to the Humane Society to meet this dog. When we walked through the doors and were getting acquainted with the staff there, we let them know we've got 2 cats at home, and they say, "Oh, we haven't cat tested this dog." Now, I didn't know there was a cat test for dogs to pass, but apparently they put a cat in a crate, bring the cat into the room, then bring the dog in. If the dog responds aggressively, the dog fails the cat test. So they said, "Wait a minute, we'll do a cat test." So they come back 10 minutes later and say she failed. So that dog was no longer a viable option for us. But the staffer said, "Would you consider one of our other special needs dogs?" I thought, well, I have been praying that God will lead us to the right one. I said, "Who did you have in mind?" And he showed me a picture of a pit bull terrier mix. Now, I have never imagined myself owning a pit bull. I know with my brain that the reputation of pit bulls are largely, it's largely fallacious, but it's been pounded into me over the years, and so I just have sort of this inherent fear for pit bulls, you know, those big jaws, and we got two cats at home, and what if there's some aggression, and yet I'd been praying, and so I said, we'll meet the dog. So they brought us into a big room, they brought the dog in, and she was absolutely petrified of us. Kept running in nervous circles far around us, kept going to the door of the room trying to get out. We kept trying to coax her with food, with toys, with everything. She would not come. She even anxiety peed, which is not the way to make a good impression on a potential adoptive parent, right? But meanwhile, my heart is going out in pity and realizing this dog is virtually unadoptable. So I said to the staffer, tell you what if we come back in a couple days and try again? So that's what we did. 2 days later, we came back. The dog was brought in the room, still very standoffish, but within 10 minutes, the ice was broken. And before long, she was eating out of our hands, bringing her toys to us. We said, we'll take her. So we took her home. And already I was falling in love with her, but if I'm going to be completely honest with you, I would have to tell you that I was also thinking, though I'm falling in love with her, she's not a very pretty dog. If the truth be told, I was thinking, she's an ugly dog. You could go ahead, boo, or walk out if you want. Because you see, over the years, that message, pit bulls bad, pit bulls mean, pit bulls aggressive, had in my mind then been associated with pit bulls ugly. But as I began to introduce her to the first 4, 5, 6 people, every single person I introduced her to said some variation on the following statement, oh my goodness, what a beautiful dog. And after like the fourth person said that, it's like suddenly the scales fell from my eyes and I could see the incredible beauty of this magnificent creature of God. But you see, that's the power of our culture to shape how we think and how we see. By the way, do you want to see a picture of it? This is our doggy. Isn't she beautiful? Her name is Ori. I now call her Oreo, not because of the cookie, but because she is so mischievous and does so many bad things that I'm constantly walking into the room and saying, Ori, oh, what did you do now? So she's Ori, oh, but look at that pink nose. When I first saw her, I thought, she's got a bald nose. That's a defect, but now I see it as a beauty mark. It sets off her colors so wonderfully. Look at those markings. Look at those ears. But I swear to you, when I first met her, I couldn't see any of that because that cultural message about pit bulls, and by the way, she's a baby. She's so sweet. But the cultural messages were so powerful and had indoctrinated me, and it took contrary viewpoints repeatedly to awaken me. We are all creatures of the culture around us. Sometimes that's good, but sometimes it's not. We have to keep asking questions and listening to differing opinions, so on and so forth. But I'm mentioning this, I'm telling you this story this morning because that cultural effect on us is profoundly relevant for today's topic, money and material possessions. We live in a culture that has pounded into our brains a certain way of seeing our money and our material possessions. We, the vast majority of us, have had the privilege of being born and raised here in the United States of America in the middle of a bubble of prosperity that is absolutely incredible and unparalleled. But we're oblivious to it because it's our normal. It's what we've always known. And so we don't tend to think of ourselves as being prosperous people. But do you know that of the 8.3 billion people who live on planet Earth, almost half, 3.5 billion, struggle to survive on less than $2,500 per year? Could you live on that? Can you imagine? If you make $34,000 a year, did you know that that means you are making more than 99% of the people on this globe right now, which puts you in the top 1% of wealth in this world? And yet most of us don't think of ourselves as being prosperous. Most of us think of ourselves as being middle class, maybe lower middle class. Some of us think of ourselves as being poor. And yet the vast majority of us are in the top 1% of wealth in this world. And that's just a global comparison. Our prosperity, the material blessings that we have become even more dramatic when we compare ourselves to history. The poorest person in this room today has access to creature comforts and material blessings that kings and queens in prior centuries would have killed for. The poorest person in this room who gets in a vehicle or hops on a bus is able to travel in an hour, a distance that King Tut could have never imagined. It would have taken him days to travel over that territory. The poorest person in this room, someone who doesn't even have health insurance but goes to the emergency room, has access to a level of medical care that Cleopatra could not have imagined in her wildest dreams. The poorest person in this room has a smartphone or has access to a library with a computer is able to speak simultaneously in communication with people anywhere on planet Earth, something that Catherine the Great of Russia in all of her wealth never could have dreamed would ever be possible. So that we, by any measure, historically, globally, are among some of the most prosperous people who've ever lived in the history of the world. And we have cut our teeth in history's ultimate consumer culture. Do you think that hasn't affected you? Think again. Studies have shown that the average 10-year-old American child has already memorized 300 to 400 different brands. Did you know that if you live to be 80 years old, it is estimated that you will be exposed over your lifetime to 146,000 different advertisements, each of which is telling you a version of the same story? If you buy what we are selling, your life will be better and you will be happier. And so as kids, we were running around and saying, "Mama, mama, mama, can I please have Fruit Loops?" Even though they're deadly, filled with sugar and have all kinds of different dyes in them that do God knows what to our bodies, we had seen those commercials that were saying, "You will be happy, you will be so blessed when you buy Fruit Loops. Mama, mama, please let me have them." And then we grow up and become adults and we're subject to the same kinds of messages, right? We see a TV commercial about a sleek Mercedes-Benz. And we think to ourselves, "Someday, if and when I can afford a Mercedes-Benz, my life will be good and I'll be happy. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz?" You know the song. "My friends all have Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz?" Then she cackles. Now some of you who are from younger generations are thinking, "What are they singing?" It's an old Janis Joplin song. And Janis was on to something. Now, Janice was also on something. Which is probably why she was on to something. But there in that little song, she holds up before us a mirror of the message of this consumer culture that has been pounded into our heads. A study of hundreds of adults asked them, what is your current level of income? And what level of income do you think you need to be comfortable and live a good life? Do you know what the results were? The vast majority of people indicated that their life would be good and they would be comfortable when they earned a little bit more than they were at the time. Regardless of income level, everybody was saying, thinking to themselves, if I have just a little bit more, then my life will be good and comfortable. So people making $30,000 a year were thinking, when I make $35,000, then my life will be good. And people making $100,000 were thinking, when I make $110,000, then my life will be good. Everybody had bought into that cultural message that says, more is better. I'll be happier when I have more. But then, along comes Jesus with an extraordinarily countercultural message, saying something to us about money and possessions that brings us up short, just like when that fourth person said to me, what a beautiful dog. It was like, what are you saying? Really? Jesus, in our gospel lesson today, and in many other gospel passages, has for us a radically counterintuitive message about how we, if we want to follow him, should relate to money and possessions. You heard it in our gospel reading today. Amy shared from Luke chapter 12. Jesus was speaking to a crowd of people when, apparently, in the middle of his teaching, there's someone in the crowd who pops up and interrupts him and says, Luke 12, 13, teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me. It's not difficult to imagine what was going on in this family. Mom and dad had passed on, left an inheritance. Apparently, this man and his brother were there in the crowd, and he wanted Jesus to set his brother straight. This man in the crowd was apparently thinking to himself, my life will be good, and I'll be able to be happy if I can get just a little bit more of that inheritance. Jesus, tell my brother to give me more. It's what I need to be happy. And Jesus responded to him and to the crowd, and by extension to us, with these critical words. Luke 12, 15. Take care. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. That last sentence, don't miss it. That last sentence is worth its weight in gold. That last sentence, if we internalize it, can keep us from wasting a lifetime of energy pursuing happiness in something that cannot bring us happiness. Your life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. You will not find the good life, abundant life. You will not find true happiness in life through the accumulation of money and stuff. Nothing wrong with money and stuff, but it's not where it's at. We all have certain basic subsistence needs, right? Basic shelter, basic food, basic clothing. And if you don't have that, life can be miserable. But if you've got those basics, material possessions have done all they can do for us and can do nothing further to increase our net happiness. I can testify to the truth of that personally from firsthand experience. When I was a kid, one day I was flipping through a magazine. When I came to a picture of this house that it was like, wow, that's my dream house. At the time, my family lived in a small rambler, three bedrooms, one bath, 1,200 square feet. But I was staring at a picture in the magazine that was more than twice that size. Two-story L-shaped house. And I thought to myself, ugh, when I grow up, I'm going to live in a house like that, and my life will be so happy. Fast forward another 15, 20 years or so, and now I'm a young adult. Me and my husband, David, are living in our starter home, what we could afford, in the Washington, D.C. area. Guess what? It wasn't my dream home. It was a tiny brick rambler, two bedrooms, one bath, 1,200 square feet. But then fast forward another 10 or so years, and by that time I'd finished my ministerial training and was ready to leave the legal profession and move back here to Indiana to become the pastor at this church. And at that time, of course, that meant...
That was good.
And from his age, you can tell he was around back then when I... when I came back here. And so as we moved back here, we no longer had my lawyer's salary, but we still had my spouse's medical engineer salary. His company said, okay, you can move to Indiana, but you have to office out of your house. So that meant we needed a house with a home office for him. At the time, our church rented worship space from another church on Sunday evenings and had no access to that building during the week. And so that meant I was also going to have to office out of our house. Plus, that meant we needed a large enough entertainment space that we could host meetings and gatherings in our house for the church. And so when we moved back here, we ended up purchasing a home more than twice the size of our starter home. Many of you over the years visited that home, and it was a really nice house. Looks like, here's a picture of it. Oops, that's the picture of the house that I was dreaming of in the magazine. This is the picture of the house that we ended up purchasing. Finally, I was living in my dream house. And it was nice. We enjoyed it. But many times over the 27 years we lived in that house, it occurred to me, you know, we're happy now, but we were just as happy in our starter home. This wonderful house had made no net difference in our happiness. Not just that, but a couple years ago when we sold this house, and my dad sold his big house, and we moved into a multi-generational home together, half the square footage of the houses we sold, guess what? We're just as happy now, if not more happy. So that I was learning firsthand from experience that what Jesus says is oh so true. Your life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. You will not find a better life through money and material possessions. Once our subsistence needs are met, that's what money and possessions can do for us. If you happen to become prosperous, good for you. But that's not going to be able to fuel authentic happiness in your life. Okay, so Jesus, if money and material possessions are not what makes life wonderful, what is? What makes for true human happiness? Jesus tells us. In the Gospel of John, chapter 10, verse 10, Jesus said, I have come that you may have life and may have it more abundantly. Jesus says, I came to earth to show you how to live well, how to live life to its fullest, how to live life abundantly. Jesus went on to add, I am the way, the truth, and the life. In other words, I can show you the way to true life. Follow me. So, what is that way, Jesus? That way to true life? Jesus told us. In his teachings, he laid out for us a series of high spiritual values and said, live into these values and you will experience abundance in your life. When Jesus said, follow me, he was saying, follow me in the way of life that I am exhibiting for you. Live the way you see me living, according to the values you see me living. Okay, what kind of values, Jesus? What does it mean to follow you? He tells us. He says, for example, in John 15, 12, this is my commandment. He doesn't say this is one of my commandments. He says, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. In other words, Jesus is saying, invest yourself in loving well the people around you. Invest yourself in cultivating quality relationships, because that will exponentially increase your happiness. That will create an overflowing abundance in your life. And guess what? Empirical studies confirm that. For example, Harvard University recently completed an 85-year-long longitudinal study of 2,000 men and women who they traced throughout their lives, meticulously documenting the various eras of their life in an attempt to identify the elements that are most critical to creating human happiness. Do you know what the principal conclusion of that 85-year study was? That the single greatest factor in contributing to authentic human happiness is quality relationships. Exactly what Jesus told us. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. He tells us that not just for the sake of the people around us, but for our own sake, so that we can live in the true abundance that God intended for us. Love the people around you well, and your life will be good. But that's not the only high spiritual value Jesus held up for us. Another high value that he kept returning to in his teachings was generosity. Jesus said, for example, in Luke 6:38, give, and it will be given to you. Do you want life to give you a lot? Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put back into your lap. Talk about an abundance. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back. In another place, Jesus put it this way, Luke 9:24. Whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will save it. We tend to think, if I want to have a good life, I need to accumulate. It needs to be all about me. Jesus says, if you live that way, trying to save your life, you're actually going to lose it. If you really want to save your life, find real life, Jesus says, lose it for my sake. In other words, follow in my path. Give as I give, love as I love, and you will find true life. In one of our discipleship classes this past Wednesday night, our lesson happened to be on this high spiritual value of generosity. The first question in the lesson was, tell us about a time when you've done something extravagant or indulgent for yourself. One of our classmates told us how when he was a young adult, he allowed himself the indulgence of purchasing a Suzuki Hayabusa. Sorry, I keep wanting to say Hayabanga. A Suzuki Hayabusa, which, if you're not familiar with it, is like this ultimate sports motorcycle, a real muscle cycle that our classmate said could potentially go up to 200 miles an hour, which prompted us to say to this classmate, what's the fastest you ever went on your Suzuki? He got a glimmer in his eye, and he said, 175 miles an hour. Can you imagine? And he said, it was thrilling. Dangerous, yes. Reckless, yes. But thrilling. He really enjoyed his Suzuki. Later in the class, another question we discussed was, tell us one of the most generous things you've ever done in your life. That same classmate told us a story, not unlike the story I began today's sermon with. A homeless person on the street asking for help. This classmate was walking past him. This classmate at the time was making a high income. And as he walked past this homeless person, God's spirit stirred in him, you know, share with this person. But our classmate realized that in his wallet at the time, he only had big bills. I mean, big bills. But God's spirit moved in him, and he stopped. He pulled out his billfold. He pulled out one of those big bills and handed it to the homeless man. The homeless man was flabbergasted and so grateful. I mean, this big bill was going to make a big difference in that man's life. And our classmate said to us, that is one of the best memories of my lifetime. Our classmate said to us, and I won't get his words exactly right, but the gist of what he said to us was, he says, as wonderful as my Suzuki was, what I experienced with that Suzuki pales in comparison to what I experienced in interacting with that homeless man. And as he was grappling for words to describe it, he said, what I felt with that homeless man was eternal. That's the word he used, eternal. In other words, that's something he will be able to carry with him and that will give him joy for the rest of his life and all of eternity. So the Suzuki was great, but he said, compared to that experience of generosity, the Suzuki was nothing. That's what Jesus is trying to teach us. Do you want real happiness? Don't become preoccupied with prosperity and material possessions, because that's not where it's at. We're all tempted. We all struggle with that. We all have our moments. A woman who was the wife of a pastor was out shopping one day. Walking past Macy's in the window, she saw this incredible designer dress. She knew she couldn't afford it, but she thought, just for fun, I'm going to try it on. So she tried it on, looked at herself in the mirror, and she thought, oh, I've got to have this. A voice whispering in her ear, you'll be so happy if you have this dress. She bought it, took it home. Her husband, the pastor, when he saw the price tag, was flabbergasted. He said, you know we can't afford this. What were you thinking? She said, I know. She said, but the devil was whispering in my ear, saying, girl, you look good in that dress. You should buy it. Her husband said, you know what you're supposed to say when Satan tempts you. You're supposed to say, get thee behind me, Satan. She said, I did. That's exactly what I said. And then from behind me, Satan said, it looks even better from back here. We all have our moments, right? But don't get carried away with it, because in the final analysis, it doesn't increase net happiness. You're familiar, maybe, with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, a psychological construct that is meant to map out a pyramid that leads us to greatest human happiness. Maslow called it actualization. If we were to create a similar pyramid that we might call the spiritual pyramid of needs, according to Jesus, the spiritual hierarchy of needs, the pyramid might look something like this. Just like Maslow's hierarchy, it begins at the base with basic shelter, food, and clothing. Without that, life can be miserable. But then, if you really want to experience happiness, fullness of life, You have to build on that by living the values of Jesus. Following those high values, love, generosity, living in the way that Jesus taught us. But notice, that still leaves a puzzle piece at the top of the pyramid. We haven't yet reached the top of the pyramid because there's still one more missing piece that we have to add to the equation, according to Jesus, if we want to experience highest human happiness. And the Bible tells us what that missing piece is. I love the way Isaiah 26:3 puts this. Thou, referring to God, thou, O God, will keep in perfect peace the one whose mind is stayed on thee. The Hebrew word translated as peace there is shalom. Shalom is the Hebrew word that means the highest state of human contentment and happiness. So this verse is telling us that God will keep in perfect shalom, in perfect contentment and happiness, the person whose mind is stayed on God. In other words, when your spirit connects to the great spirit, God Almighty, that's when we finally position ourselves to experience the highest form of human happiness. St. Augustine put it this way: our hearts are restless, O God, until they find their rest in you. The psalmist puts it this way: better is a day in your courts than a thousand elsewhere. The psalmist is saying, one day in the presence of God is better than a thousand days outside the presence of God. That's the difference, the exponential difference in contentment and happiness that comes from living in the presence of God, establishing a close personal connection with God. So, if we were to complete our spiritual hierarchy of needs, that top puzzle piece that takes us to the top, that takes us to shalom, the highest state of human happiness, is close personal connection with God. That middle part, that's what you might call the ethical part of spiritual living. Behaving as Jesus taught us to behave. Living in the way of Jesus. The top part is what you might call the relational part of spiritual life. Building a close personal relation with God. It takes both of those to reach shalom in our life. Let me illustrate what I'm talking about. A while back, I was talking about my new dog, Ori. Ori O loves many things. She loves to run. She loves to retrieve. She loves to play fight. She loves to tug of war. She loves food. And she also loves to jump on our dining room table. 65-pound behemoth. We leave the house for a few minutes, come back. She's on the dining room table because that allows her to see out the window and see if there's action out there. She is, if she were a child, she'd be diagnosed with ADD and hyperactivity, right? Play with this toy. No, that toy's not good enough. Play with this toy. No. A constant search for what the next thing that's going to make her happy. If she had a middle name, it would be Restless, right? She is high energy. It's one of her behavioral challenges. A week ago Saturday, I told David, I'm going to go jogging for a little while. 45 minutes later, when I come back to the house, he says to me, oh my goodness, he says, the whole time you were gone, Ori was restless and depressed. So I walked over to the couch and I sat down next to Ori. She was sitting up and she just sort of leaned into me. So I put my arms around her like this and just held her. And she was, for the first time in her waking moments, it's the first time I've seen her completely still, because she was soaking in the love of her master. After about a minute, she collapsed onto my lap and just lay there completely still while I pet her and talked to her. First time I've seen her completely at rest, because the presence of her master became the source of her highest happiness. It's like that with us and God. We try a lot of different things that short term give us a blip, and then we find ourselves saying, but that's not it. The it is connection to God. So here is the seventh core characteristic of authentic followers of Jesus. Authentic followers of Jesus learn to love God and spiritual life so deeply that money and material things become secondary and incidental to them. Again, I can testify from personal experience to the truth of that. I told you a couple weeks ago how in the middle of my high school years, my family moved from Indiana to Colorado Springs, and I landed in this ginormous high school where I was a stranger and alone and feeling so forlorn. But every day at the end of school, I would get in our family's Volkswagen and drive 10 minutes to Austin Bluffs, the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. And from there on the cliffs of Austin Bluffs, I could overlook the entire city of Colorado Springs and the front range of the Rocky Mountains stretching for as far as the eye can see. And there I could watch beautiful sunsets over the Rockies and the lights coming on in the city below. And in that wilderness place, all alone, I could walk with God and talk with God. And that's when God became my best friend. I could feel the presence of God. I could feel the love of God holding me. My soul could sense God speaking to me words of insight and wisdom and comfort and encouragement. Nothing better in life. That's where I began to experience shalom. You could say, Jeff, for those moments in Austin Bluffs, you give those up and we'll trade you 1,000 years of being the most popular kid in high school. And I would say, no deal. It's not worth it. Give me Austin Bluffs. Give me the presence of God. How about you? Have you made that kind of close personal connection to God? If so, keep building that connection. And if not, but if you're at a place in your life where you say, I think I'm ready to start walking that path that Jesus taught us, then here's what I want to invite you to consider doing. Go to lifejourney.church/links and click on the response form you find there and scroll down, and you'll find a place on the response form where there are decisional options. One of those options is to check the box that says, I'm ready to become a committed follower of Jesus. Another box says, I long ago made that decision, but I need to renew that decision. Another option is a box that says, I'm not sure I'm ready to follow Jesus, but I want more information about what that looks like. A fourth box is blank, and you can fill in the blank. If the Spirit of God is moving in your spirit today, and you say, I need to make a decision to follow Jesus, to get my life on track, to begin to experience true abundance in life, fill out that form. I'll then reach out to you. We'll schedule a time, and we'll talk about next steps, how to implement that decision in your life. Our life matters. We can't live the good life apart from the great Spirit, God's Spirit. Build relationship with God. Build relationship with the people around you. Live generously, and you will experience shalom.